hands of the brave young prince. But one day, the king grew ill. Rumor began to spread that he was being poisoned by his new wife. Stories circulated that she had conjured grave magics to make herself look far younger than she actually was, and that beneath her youthful face lurked the scowl of an elderly hag. No one would have put it past her to poison the king, though he begged his subjects until his dying breath not to blame her. And so he died, with still a year left before his grandson was old enough to take the throne. The queen, his step-grandmother, became regent in his place, and would handle all affairs of state until the prince was old enough to take over. At first, to the surprise of many, her reign was a good one. Her countenance, despite the rumors, was still youthful and pleasing, and she endeavored to carry on ruling in the manner of the dead king. The prince, meanwhile, had fallen in love.
I knew it, Connor grumbled. These kinds of stories always have stupid princes falling in love. He started walking back to the house. I thought this was going to be good. With one swift movement, the monster grabbed Connor's ankles in a long, strong hand and flipped him upside down, holding him in midair so his t-shirt rucked up and his heartbeat thudded in his head.
As I was saying, said the monster. The prince had fallen in love. She was only a farmer's daughter, but she was beautiful and also smart, as the daughters of farmers need to be, for farms are complicated businesses. The kingdom smiled on the match. The queen, however, did not. She had enjoyed her time as regent and felt a strange reluctance to give it up. She began to think that perhaps it was best that the crown remained in the family, that the kingdom be run by those wise enough to do it. And what could be a better solution than for the prince to actually marry her?
That's disgusting, Connor said, still upside down. She was his grandmother.
Step-grandmother, corrected the monster. Not related by blood, and to all intents and appearances, a young woman herself.
Connor shook his hair dangling. That's just wrong. He paused a moment. Can you maybe put me down? The monster lowered him to the ground and continued the story.
The prince also thought marrying the queen was wrong. He said he would die before doing any such thing. He vowed to run away with the beautiful farmer's daughter and return on his 18th birthday to free his people from the tyranny of the queen. And so, one night, the prince and the farmer's daughter raced away on horseback, stopping only at dawn to sleep in the shade of a giant yew tree.
You? Connor asked.
Me, the monster said, but also only part of me. I can take any form of any size, but the yew tree is a shape most comfortable. The prince and the farmer's daughter held each other close in the growing dawn. They had vowed to be chaste until they were able to marry in the next kingdom, but their passions got the better of them, and it was not long before they were asleep and naked in each other's arms. They slept through the day in the shadows of my branches, and night fell once again. The prince woke. "Arise, my beloved," he whispered to the farmer's daughter, "for we ride to the day where we will be man and wife." But his beloved did not wake. He shook her, and it was only as she slumped back in the moonlight that he noticed the blood staining the ground.
"Blood," Connor said, but the monster kept talking.
The prince also had blood covering his own hands, and he saw a bloodied knife on the grass beside them, resting against the roots of the tree. Someone had murdered his beloved, and done so in a way that made it look like the prince had committed the crime. "The queen," cried the prince, "the queen is responsible for this treachery." In the distance, he could hear villagers approaching. If they found him, they would see the knife and the blood, and they would call him murderer. They would put him to death for his crime.
"And the queen would be able to rule unchallenged," Connor said, making a disgusted sound. "I hope this story ends with you ripping her head off."
There was nowhere for the prince to run. His horse had been chased away while he slept. The yew tree was his only shelter, and also the only place he could turn for help. Now the world was younger then. The barrier between things was thinner, easier to pass through. The prince knew this, and he lifted his head to the great yew tree, and he spoke. The monster paused.
"What did he say?"
Connor asked. "He said enough to bring me walking," the monster said. "I know injustice when I see it." The prince ran towards the approaching villagers. "The queen has murdered my bride," he shouted. "The queen must be stopped." The rumors of the queen's witchery had been circulating long enough, and the young prince was so beloved of the people that it took very little for them to see the obvious truth. It took even less time when they saw the great green man walking behind him, high as the hills, coming for vengeance. Connor glanced again at the monster's massive arms and legs, at its raggedy, toothy mouth, at its overwhelming monstrousness. He imagined what the queen must have thought when she saw it coming. He smiled. The subject stormed the queen's castle with such fury that the stones of its very walls tumbled. Fortifications fell, and ceilings collapsed, and when the queen was found in her chambers, the mob seized her and dragged her to the stake right then to burn her alive.
"Good," Connor said, smiling. "She deserved it."
He looked up at his bedroom window, where his grandmother slept.
"I don't suppose you can help me with her?" he asked. "I mean, I don't want to burn her alive or anything, but maybe just..."
"The story," said the monster, "is not yet finished."
The rest of the first tale.
"It's not?" Connor asked. "But the queen was overthrown."
"She was," said the monster, "but not by me."
Connor hesitated, confused.
"You said you made sure she was never seen again."
"And so I did. When the villagers lit the flames on the stake to burn her alive, I reached in and saved her."
"You what?"
Connor said. "I took her and carried her far enough away so that the villagers would never find her. Far beyond even the kingdom of her birth, to a village by the sea. And there I left her, to live in peace."
Connor got to his feet, his voice rising in disbelief.
"But she murdered the farmer's daughter! How could you possibly save a murderer?"
Then his face dropped, and he took a step back. "You really are a monster."
"I never said she killed the farmer's daughter," the monster said. "I only said that the prince said it was so."
Connor blinked. Then he crossed his arms.
"So who killed her then?"
The monster opened its huge hands in a certain way, and a breeze blew up, bringing a mist with it. Connor's house was still behind him, but the mist covered his back garden, replacing it with a field with a giant yew in the center, and a man and a woman sleeping at its base.
"After their coupling," said the monster, "the prince remained awake."
Connor watched as the young prince rose and looked down at the sleeping farmer's daughter, who even Connor could see was a beauty. The prince watched her for a moment, then wrapped a blanket around himself and went to their horse, tied to one of the yew tree's branches. The prince retrieved something from the saddlebag, then untied the horse, slapping it hard on the hindquarters to send it running off. The prince held up what he'd taken out of the bag. A knife, shining in the moonlight.
"No,"
Connor said.
The monster closed its hands, and the mist descended again as the prince approached the sleeping farmer's daughter, his knife at the ready.
"You said he was surprised when she didn't wake up,"
Connor said.
"After he killed the farmer's daughter," said the monster, "the prince lay down next to her and returned to sleep. When he awoke, he acted out a pantomime should anyone be watching, but also, it may surprise you to learn, for himself."
The monster's branches creaked.
Sometimes people need to lie to themselves most of all.
You said he asked for your help and that you gave it.
I only said he told me enough to make me come walking.
Connor looked wide-eyed from the monster to his back garden, which was re-emerging from the dissipating mist.
What did he tell you?
He asked.
He told me that he had done it for the good of the kingdom, that the new queen was in fact a witch, that his grandfather had suspected it to be true when he married her, but that he had overlooked it because of her beauty. The prince couldn't topple a powerful witch on his own. He needed the fury of the villagers to help him. The death of the farmer's daughter saw to that. He was sorry to do it, heartbroken, he said, but as his own father had died in defense of the kingdom, so did his fair maiden. Her death was serving to overthrow a great evil. When he said that the queen had murdered his bride, he believed, in his own way, that it was actually true.
That's a load of crap, Connor shouted. He didn't need to kill her. The people were behind him. They would have followed him anyway.
The justifications of men who kill should always be heard with skepticism, said the monster. And so the injustice that I saw, the reason that I came walking, was for the queen, not the prince.
Did he ever get caught? Connor said, aghast. Did they punish him?
He became a much beloved king, the monster said, who ruled happily until the end of his long days.
Connor looked up to his bedroom window, frowning again.
So, the good prince was a murderer, and the evil queen wasn't a witch after all? Is that supposed to be the lesson of all this? That I should be nice to her?
He heard a strange rumbling, different from before, and it took him a minute to realize the monster was laughing.
You think I tell you stories to teach you lessons? The monster said. You think I have come walking out of time and earth itself to teach you a lesson in niceness?
It laughed louder and louder again, until the ground was shaking, and it felt like the sky itself might tumble down.
Yeah, all right,
Connor said, embarrassed.
No,
the monster said, finally calming itself.
The queen most certainly was a witch, and could very well have been on her way to great evil. Who's to say? She was trying to hold on to power, after all.
Why did you save her, then?
Because what she was not was a murderer.
Connor walked around the garden a bit, thinking. Then he did a bit more.
I don't understand. Who's the good guy here?
There is not always a good guy. Nor is there always a bad one. Most people are somewhere in between.
Connor shook his head.
That's a terrible story, and a cheat.
It is a true story, the monster said. Many things that are true feel like a cheat. Kingdoms get the princes they deserve. Farmers' daughters die for no reason. And sometimes witches merit saving. Quite often, actually. You'd be surprised.
Connor glanced up at his bedroom window again, imagining his grandma sleeping in his bed.
So how is that supposed to save me from her?
The monster stood to its full height, looking down on Connor from afar.
It is not her you need saving from, it said.
Connor sat up straight on the settee, breathing heavily again. 12:07, read the clock.
Damn it, Connor said. Am I dreaming or not?
He stood up angrily and immediately stubbed his toe.
What now?
He grumbled, leaning over to flick on a light. From a knot in a floorboard, a fresh, new, and very solid sapling had sprouted, about a foot tall. Connor stared at it for a while. Then he went to the kitchen to get a knife, to saw it out of the floor.
Understanding. I forgive you, Lily said,
catching up with him on the walk to school the following day.
For what?
Connor asked, not looking at her.
He was still irritated at the monster's story, from the cheating and twisting way it went, none of which was any help at all. He'd spent half an hour sawing the surprisingly tough sapling out of the floor, and had felt as though he'd barely fallen asleep again before it was time to get up. Something he'd only found out because his grandma had started yelling at him for being late. She wouldn't even let him say goodbye to his mum, who she said had had a rough night and needed her rest. Which made him feel guilty, because if his mum had had a rough night, then he should have been there to help her, not his grandma, who had barely let him brush his teeth before shoving an apple in his hand and pushing him out of the door. "I forgive you for getting me in trouble, stupid," Lily said, but not too harshly. "You got yourself in trouble," Connor said. "You're the one who pushed Sully over." "I forgive you for lying," Lily said. Her poodly curls shoved painfully back into a band. Connor just kept on walking. "Aren't you going to say you're sorry back?" Lily asked. "Nope," Connor said.
"Why not?"
"Because I'm not sorry."
"Connor, I'm not sorry,"
Connor said, stopping.
"And I don't forgive you."
They glared at each other in the cool morning sun, neither wanting to be the first to look away.
"My mum said we need to make allowances for you," Lily finally said, "because of what you're going through."
And for a moment, the sun seemed to go behind the clouds. For a moment, all Connor could see was sudden thunderstorms on the way, could feel them ready to explode in the sky and through his body and out of his fists. For a moment, he felt as if he could grab hold of the very air and twist it around Lily and rip her right in two.
"Connor,"
Lily said, startled.
"Your mum doesn't know anything," he said, "and neither do you."
He walked away from her, fast, leaving her behind. It was just over a year ago that Lily had told a few of her friends about Connor's mum, even though he hadn't said she could. Those friends told a few more, who told a few more, and before the day was half through, it was like a circle had opened around him. A dead area, with Connor at the centre, surrounded by landmines that everyone was afraid to walk through. All of a sudden, the people he'd thought were his friends would stop talking when he came over. Not that there were so very many beyond Lily anyway, but still. He'd catch people whispering as he walked by in the corridor or at lunch. Even teachers would get a different look on their faces when he put up his hand in lessons. So eventually, he stopped going over to groups of friends, stopped looking up at the whispers, and even stopped putting up his hand. Not that anyone seemed to notice. It was like he'd suddenly turned invisible. He'd never had a harder year of school or been more relieved for a summer holiday to come round than this last one. His mother was deep into her treatments, which she'd said over and over again were rough, but doing the job. The long schedule of them nearing its end. The plan was that she'd finish them, a new school year would start, and they'd be able to put all this behind them and start afresh. Except it hadn't worked out that way. His mum's treatments had carried on longer than they'd originally thought. First a second round, and now a third. The teachers in his new year were even worse, because they only knew him in terms of his mum, and not who he was before. And the other kids still treated him like he was the one who was ill, especially since Harry and his cronies had singled him out. And now his grandma was hanging around the house, and he was dreaming about trees. Or maybe it wasn't a dream, which would actually be worse. He walked on angrily to school. He blamed Lily because it was mostly her fault, wasn't it? He blamed Lily because who else was there? This time, Harry's fist was in his stomach. Connor fell to the ground, scraping his knee on the concrete step, tearing a hole in his uniform trousers. The hole was the worst part of it. He was terrible at sewing.
"She's such a spaz, O'Malley," Sully said, laughing behind him somewhere. "It's like you fall every day." "You should go to a doctor for that," he heard Anton say.
"Maybe he's drunk," Sully said, and there was more laughter, except for a silent spot between them, where Connor knew Harry wasn't laughing. He knew without looking back that Harry was just watching him, waiting to see what he would do. As he stood, he saw Lily against the school wall. She was with some other girls, heading back inside at the end of break time. She wasn't talking to them, just looking at Connor as she walked away.
No help from Super Poodle today,
Sully said, still laughing.
Lucky for you, Sully, Harry said, speaking for the first time.
Connor still hadn't turned back to face them, but he could tell Harry wasn't laughing at Sully's joke. Connor watched Lily until she was gone.
Hey, look at us when we're talking to you,
Sully said, burning from Harry's comment, no doubt, and grabbing Connor's shoulder, spinning him around.
Don't touch him, Harry said, calm and low, but so ominously that Sully immediately stepped back.
O'Malley and I have an understanding, Harry said. I'm the only one who touches him. Isn't that right?
Connor waited for a moment, and then slowly nodded. That did seem to be the understanding. Harry, his face still blank, his eyes still locked on Connor's, stepped up close to him. Connor didn't flinch, and they stood eye to eye while Anton and Sully looked at each other a bit nervously. Harry cocked his head slightly, as if a question had occurred to him, one he was trying to puzzle out. Connor still didn't move. The rest of their year had already gone inside. He could feel the quiet opening up around them, even Anton and Sully falling silent. They would have to go soon. They needed to go now. But nobody moved. Harry raised a fist and pulled it back as if to swing it at Connor's face. Connor still didn't flinch. He didn't even move. He just stared into Harry's eyes, waiting for the punch to fall. But it didn't. Harry lowered his fist, dropping it slowly down by his side, still staring at Connor.
Yes, he finally said, quietly, as if he'd worked something out.
That's what I thought. And then once more came the voice of Doom.
You boys!
Miss Kwan called, coming across the yard towards them like terror on two legs.
Break was over 3 minutes ago. What do you think you're still doing out here?
Sorry, miss, Harry said, his voice suddenly light. We were discussing Mrs. Miles' life-writing homework with Connor and lost track of time.
He slapped a hand on Connor's shoulder, as if they were lifelong friends.
No one knows about stories like Connor here.
He nodded seriously at Miss Kwan.
And talking about it helps get him out of himself.
Yes, Miss Kwan frowned.
That sounds entirely likely.
Everyone here is on first warning. One more problem today, and that's detention for all of you.
Yes, miss,
Harry said brightly, with Anton and Sully mumbling the same. They trudged off back to lessons, Connor following in step a meter behind.
A moment, please, Connor,
Miss Kwan said. He stopped and turned to her, but didn't look up at her face.
Are you sure everything's all right between you and those boys?
Miss Kwan said, putting her voice into its kindly mode, which was only slightly less scary than full-on shouting.
Yes, miss, Connor said, still not looking at her. Because I'm not blind to how Harry works, you know, she said. A bully with charisma and top marks is still a bully.
She sighed, annoyed.
He'll probably end up Prime Minister one day, God help us all.
Connor said nothing, and the silence took on a particular quality, one he was familiar with, caused by how Miss Kwan's body shifted forward, her shoulders dropping, her head leaning down towards Connor's. He knew what was coming. He knew and hated it.
I can't imagine what you must be going through, Connor,
Miss Kwan said, so quiet it was almost a whisper.
But if you ever want to talk, my door is always open.
He couldn't look at her, couldn't see the care there, couldn't bear to hear it in her voice. Because he didn't deserve it. The nightmare flashed in him, the screaming and the terror, and what happened at the end.
I'm fine, miss, he mumbled, looking at his shoes. I'm not going through anything.
After a second, he heard Miss Kwan sigh again.
All right, then, she said. Forget about the first warning and come back inside.
She patted him once on the shoulder and recrossed the yard to the doors. And for a moment, Connor was entirely alone. He knew right then he could probably stay out there all day and no one would punish him for it, which somehow made him feel even worse.
Little Talk. After school, his grandma was waiting for him on the settee.
"We need to have a talk," she said, before he even got the door shut. And there was a look on her face that made him stop, a look that made his stomach hurt.
"What's wrong?" he asked. His grandmother took in a long, loud breath through her nose and stared out of the front window, as if gathering herself. She looked like a bird of prey, a hawk that could carry off a sheep.
"Your mother has to go back to the hospital," she said. "You're going to come and stay with me for a few days. You'll need to pack a bag."
Connor didn't move.
"What's wrong with her?"
His grandma's eyes widened for just a second, as if she couldn't believe he was asking a question so cataclysmically stupid. Then she relented.
"There's a lot of pain," she said. "More than there should be."
"She's got medicine for her pain," Connor started. But his grandmother clapped her hands together, just the once, but loud. Loud enough to stop him.
"It's not working, Connor," she said, crisply. And it seemed like she was looking just over his head, rather than at him. "It's not working."
"What's not working?" His grandma tapped her hands together lightly a few more times, like she was testing them out or something. Then she looked out of the window again, all the while keeping her mouth firmly shut. She finally stood, concentrating on smoothing down her dress.
"Your mum's upstairs," she said. "She wants to talk to you." "But your father's flying in on Sunday."
He straightened up.
"Dad's coming."
"I've got some calls to make," she said, stepping past him and out of the front door, taking out her mobile.
"Why is Dad coming?"
he called after her.
"Your mum's waiting," she said,
pulling the front door shut behind her. Connor hadn't even had a chance to put down his rucksack. His father was coming. His father? From America? Who hadn't come since the Christmas before last, whose new wife always seemed to suffer emergencies at the last minute that kept him from visiting more often, especially now that the baby was born. His father, who Connor had grown used to not having around as the trips grew less frequent and the phone calls got further and further apart. His father was coming. Why?
"Connor!"
he heard his mum call. She wasn't in her room. She was in his, lying back on his bed on top of the duvet, gazing out of the window to the churchyard up the hill, and the yew tree, which was just a yew tree.
"Hey, darling," she said,
smiling at him from where she lay. But he could tell by the lines around her eyes that she really was hurting, hurting like he'd only seen her hurt once before. She'd had to go into hospital then as well, and hadn't come out for nearly a fortnight. It had been last Easter, and the weeks at his grandma's had almost been the death of them both.
"What's the matter?"
he asked.
"Why are you going back to hospital?"
She patted the duvet next to her to get him to come and sit down. He stayed where he was.
"What's wrong?"
She still smiled, but it was tighter now. And she traced her fingers along the threaded pattern of the duvet, grizzly bears that Connor had outgrown years ago. She had tied her red rose scarf around her head, but only loosely, and he could see her pale scalp underneath. He didn't think she'd even pretended to try on any of his grandma's old wigs.
"I'm going to be okay," she said. "I really am."
"Are you?"
he asked.
"We've been here before, Connor," she said, "so don't worry. I've felt really bad, and I've gone in, and they've taken care of it. That's what'll happen this time."
She patted the duvet cover again.
"Won't you come and sit down next to your tired old mum?"
Connor swallowed, but her smile was brighter, and, he could tell, it was a real one. He went over and sat next to her on the side facing the window. She ran her hand through his hair, lifting it out of his eyes, and he could see how skinny her arm was, almost like it was just bone and skin.
"Why's Dad coming?" he asked.
His mother paused, then put her hand back down into her lap.
"It's been a while since you've seen him. Aren't you excited?"
"Grandma doesn't seem too happy," his mother snorted.
"Well, you know how she feels about your dad. Don't listen to her. Enjoy his visit."
They sat in silence for a moment.
There's something else, Connor finally said, isn't there? He felt his mother sit up a little straighter on her pillow.
Look at me, son, she said gently.
He turned his head to look at her, though he would have paid £1 million not to have to do it.
This latest treatment's not doing what it's supposed to, she said. All that means is they're going to have to adjust it. Try something else.
Is that it? Connor asked. She nodded.
That's it. There's lots more they can do. It's normal. Don't worry.
You sure?
Sure.
Because, and here Connor stopped for a second and looked down at the floor. Because you could tell me, you know. Then he felt her arms around him. Her thin, thin arms that used to be so soft when she hugged him. She didn't say anything, just held on to him. He went back to looking out of the window, and after a moment, his mother turned to look too.
That's a yew tree, you know, she finally said.
Connor rolled his eyes, but not in a bad way.
Yes, Mum, you've told me 100 times. Keep an eye on it for me while I'm away, will you? She said. Make sure it's still here when I get back.
And Connor knew this was her way of telling him she was coming back. So all he did was nod, and they both kept looking out at the tree. Which stayed a tree, no matter how long they looked. Grandma's house. 5 days. The monster hadn't come for 5 days. Maybe it didn't know where his grandma lived. Or maybe it was just too far to come. She didn't have much of a garden anyway, even though her house was way bigger than Connor and his mum's. She'd crammed her back garden with sheds and a stone pond and a wood-panelled office she'd had installed across the back half, where she did most of her estate agent work, a job so boring Connor never listened past the first sentence of her description of it. Everything else was just brick paths and flowers in pots. No room for a tree at all. It didn't even have grass.
Don't stand there gawping, young man,
his grandma said, leaning out of the back door and hooking in an earring.
Your dad'll be here soon, and I'm going to see your mum.
I wasn't gawping, Connor said.
What's that got to do with the price of milk? Come inside.
She vanished into the house, and he slowly trudged after her. It was Sunday, the day his father would be arriving from the airport. He would come here and pick up Connor. They'd go and see his mum, and then they'd spend some father-son time together. Connor was almost certain this was code for another round of we need to have a talk. His grandma wouldn't be here when his father arrived, which suited everyone.
Pick up your rucksack from the front hall, please,
she said, stepping past him and grabbing her handbag.
No need for him to think I'm keeping you in a pigsty.
Not much chance of that, Connor muttered, as she went to the hall mirror to check her lipstick. His grandma's house was cleaner than his mum's hospital room. Her cleaning lady, Marta, came on Wednesdays, but Connor didn't see why she bothered. His grandma would get up first thing in the morning to Hoover, did laundry 4 times a week, and once cleaned the bath at midnight before going to bed. She wouldn't let dinner dishes touch the sink on their way to the dishwasher, once even taking a plate Connor was still eating from.
A woman my age living alone, she said,
at least once a day.
If I don't keep on top of things, who will?
She said it like a challenge, as if defying Connor to answer. She drove him to school, and he got there early every single day, even though it was a 45-minute drive. She was also waiting for him every day after school when he left, taking them both straight to the hospital to see his mum. They'd stay for an hour or so, less if his mum was too tired to talk, which had happened twice out of the previous 5 days, and then go home to his grandma's house, where she'd make him do his homework while she ordered whatever takeaway they hadn't already eaten so far. It was like the time Connor and his mum had stayed in a bed and breakfast one summer in Cornwall, except cleaner and bossier.
Now, Connor, she said, slipping on her suit jacket.
It was a Sunday, but she didn't have any houses to show, so he wasn't sure why she was dressing up so much just to go to the hospital. He suspected it probably had something to do with making his dad uncomfortable.
Your father may not notice how tired your mum's been getting, okay? She said. So we're going to have to work together to make sure he doesn't overstay his welcome.
She checked herself in the mirror again and lowered her voice. Not that that's been a problem. She turned, gave him a flash of starfish hand as a wave, and said, Be good. The door clattered shut behind her. Connor was alone in her house. He went up to the guest room where he slept. His grandma kept calling it his room, but he only ever called it the guest room, which always made his grandmother shake her head and mumble to herself. But what did she expect? It didn't look like his room. It didn't look like anybody's room, certainly not a boy's. The walls were bare white, except for three different prints of sailing ships, which was probably as far as his grandma's thinking went towards what boys might like. The sheets and duvet covers were a bright, blinding white, too, and the only other piece of furniture was an oak cabinet big enough to have lunch in. It could have been any room, in any home, on any planet, anywhere. He didn't even like being in it, not even to get away from his grandma. He'd only come up now to get a book, since his grandma had forbidden handheld computer games in her house. He fished one out of his bag and made to leave, glancing out of the window to the back garden as he went. Still just stone paths and sheds and the office. Nothing looking back at him at all. The sitting room was one of those sitting rooms where no one ever actually sat. Connor wasn't allowed in there at any time, lest he smudged the upholstery somehow. So, of course, this was where he went to read his book while he waited for his father. He slumped down on her settee, which had curved wooden legs so thin it looked like it was wearing high heels. There was a glass-fronted cabinet opposite, filled with plates on display stands and teacups with so many curlicues it was a wonder you could drink from them without cutting your lips. Hanging over the mantelpiece was his grandma's prize clock, which no one but her could ever touch. Handed down from her own mother, Connor's grandma had threatened for years to take it on Antiques Roadshow to get it valued. It had a proper pendulum swinging underneath it, and it chimed too, every 15 minutes, loud enough to make you jump if you weren't expecting it. The whole room was like a museum of how people lived in olden times. There wasn't even a television. That was in the kitchen and almost never switched on. He read. What else was there to do? He had hoped to talk to his father before he flew out, but what with the hospital visits and the time difference and the new wife's convenient migraines, he was just going to have to see him when he showed up. Whenever that would be. Connor looked at the pendulum clock. 12:42, it said. It would chime in 3 minutes. Three empty, quiet minutes. He realized he was actually nervous. It had been a long time since he'd seen his father in person, and not just on Skype. Would he look different? Would Connor look different? And then there were the other questions. Why was he coming now? His mum didn't look great, looked even worse after 5 days in the hospital, but she was still hopeful about the new medicine she was being given. Christmas was still months away, and Connor's birthday was already past. So why now? He looked at the floor, the centre of which was covered in a very expensive, very old-looking oval rug. He reached down and lifted up an edge of it, looking at the polished boards beneath. There was a knot in one of them. He ran his fingers over it, but the board was so old and smooth you couldn't tell the difference between the knot and the rest of it. "Are you in there?" Connor whispered. He jumped as the doorbell went. He scrambled up and out of the sitting room, feeling more excited than he'd thought he would. He opened the front door. There was his father, looking totally different, but exactly the same. "Hey, son," his dad said, his voice bending in that weird way that America had started to shape it. Connor smiled wider than he had for at least a year. Champ. "How are you hanging in there, champ?" his father asked him, while they waited for the waitress to bring them their pizzas. "Champ?" Connor asked, raising a skeptical eyebrow. "Sorry," his father said, smiling bashfully. "America's almost a whole different language." "Your voice sounds funnier every time I talk to you." "Yeah, well,"
His father fidgeted with his wine glass. It's good to see you.
Connor took a drink of his Coke. His mum had been really poorly when they got to the hospital. They'd had to wait for his grandma to help her out of the toilet. And then she was so tired, all she was really able to say was, "Hi, sweetheart," to Connor, and "Hello, Liam," to his father, before falling back to sleep. His grandmother ushered them out moments later, a look on her face that even his dad wasn't going to argue with. "Your mother is, his father said now, squinting at nothing in particular. "She's a fighter, isn't she?" Connor shrugged. "So how are you holding up, Con?" "That's like the 800th time you've asked me since you got here," Connor said. "Sorry," his father said. "I'm fine," Connor said. "Mum's on this new medicine. It'll make her better. She looks bad, but she's looked bad before. Why is everyone acting like..." He stopped and took another drink of his Coke. "You're right, son," his father said. "You're absolutely right." He turned his wine glass slowly around once on the table. "Still," he said, "you're going to need to be brave for her, Con. You're going to need to be real, real brave for her." "You talk like American television," his father laughed quietly. "Your sister's doing well? Almost walking?" "Half sister," Connor said. "I can't wait for you to meet her," his father said. "We'll have to arrange for a visit soon. Maybe even this Christmas. Would you like that?" Connor met his father's eyes. "What about Mum?" "Well, I talked it over with your grandma. She seemed to think it wasn't a bad idea, as long as we got you back in time for the new school term." Connor ran a hand along the edge of the table. "So it'd just be a visit then?" "What do you mean?" his father said, sounding surprised. "A visit, as opposed to..." He trailed off, and Connor knew he'd worked out what he meant. "Connor." But Connor suddenly didn't want him to finish. "There's a tree that's been visiting me," he said, talking quickly, starting to peel the label off the Coke bottle. "It comes to the house at night, tells me stories." His father blinked, baffled. "What?" "I thought it was a dream at first," Connor said, scratching at the label with his thumbnail. "But then I kept finding leaves when I woke up and little trees growing out the floor. I've been hiding them all so no one will find out. Connor, it hasn't come to Grandma's house yet. I was thinking she might live too far away. What are you... But why should it matter if it's all a dream, though? Why wouldn't a dream be able to walk across town? Not if it's as old as the earth and as big as the world. Connor, stop this! I don't want to live with Grandma!" Connor said, his voice suddenly strong and filled with a thickness that felt like it was choking him. He kept his eyes firmly on the Coke bottle label, his thumbnails scraping the wet paper away. "Why can't I come and live with you? Why can't I come to America?" His father licked his lips. You mean when..." "Grandma's house is an old lady's house," Connor said. His father gave another small laugh. "I'll be sure to tell her you called her an old lady." "You can't touch anything or sit anywhere," Connor said. "You can't leave a mess for even 2 seconds, and she's only got internet out in her office, and I'm not allowed in there." "I'm sure we can talk to her about those things. I'm sure there's lots of room to make it easier, make you comfortable there." "I don't want to be comfortable there," Connor said, raising his voice. "I want my own room in my own house." "You wouldn't have that in America," his father said. "We barely have room for the three of us, Con. Your grandma's a lot more money and space than we do. Plus, you're in school here. Your friends are here. Your whole life is here. It would be unfair to just take it out of all that." "Unfair to who?" Connor asked. His father sighed. "This is what I meant," he said. "This is what I meant when I said you were going to have to be brave." "That's what everyone says," Connor said, "as if it means anything." "I'm sorry," his father said. "I know it seems really unfair, and I wish it was different. Do you?" "Of course I do," his father leaned in over the table. "But this way is best. You'll see." Connor swallowed, still not meeting his eye. Then he swallowed again. "Can we talk about it more when Mum gets better?" His father slowly sat back in his chair again. "Of course we can, buddy. That's exactly what we'll do." Connor looked at him again. "Buddy?" His father smiled. "Sorry," He lifted his wine glass and took a drink long enough to drain the whole glass. He set it down with a small gasp, then he gave Connor a quizzical look.
"What was all that you were saying about a tree?"
But the waitress came, and silence fell as she put their pizzas in front of them.
"Americano," Connor frowned, looking down at his. "If it could talk, I wonder if it would sound like you."
Americans don't get much holiday.
"Doesn't look like your grandma's home yet,"
Connor's father said, pulling up the rental car in front of her house.
"She sometimes goes back to the hospital after I go to bed," Connor said. "The nurses let her sleep in a chair."
His dad nodded. "She may not like me," he said, "but that doesn't mean she's a bad lady." Connor stared out of the window at her house.
"How long are you here for?" he asked.
He'd been afraid to ask before now. His father let out a long breath, the kind of breath that said bad news was coming.
"Just a few days, I'm afraid."
Connor turned to him.
"That's all? Americans don't get much holiday." "You're not American."
"But I live there now," he grinned. "You're the one who made fun of my accent all night."
"Why did you come then?" Connor asked. "Why bother coming at all?"
His father waited a moment before answering.
"I came because your mum asked me to."
He looked like he was going to say more, but he didn't. Connor didn't say anything either.
"I'll come back, though," his father said. "You know, when I need to."
His voice brightened.
"And you'll visit us at Christmas.
That'll be good fun."
"In your cramped house where there's no room for me," Connor said.
"Connor, and then I'll come back here for school."
"Can't.
Why did you come?" Connor asked again, his voice low. His father didn't answer. A silence opened up in the car that felt like they were sitting on opposite sides of a canyon. Then his father reached out a hand for Connor's shoulder, but Connor ducked it and pulled on the door handle to get out.
"Connor, wait!"
Connor waited, but didn't turn around.
"You want me to come in until she gets home?"
his father asked.
"Keep you company?"
"I'm fine on my own," Connor said, and got out of the car. The house was quiet when he got inside. Why wouldn't it be? He was alone. He slumped on the expensive settee again, listening to it creak as he fell back into it. It was such a satisfying sound that he got up and slumped back down into it again. Then he got back up and jumped on it, the wooden legs moaning as they scraped a few inches across the floor, leaving four identical scratches on the hardwood. He smiled to himself. That felt good. He jumped off and gave the settee a kick to push it back even further. He was barely aware that he was breathing heavily. His head felt hot, almost like he had a fever. He raised a foot to kick the settee again. Then he looked up and saw the clock. His grandma's precious clock, hanging over the mantelpiece, the pendulum swinging back and forth, like it was getting on with its own private life, not caring about Connor at all. He approached it slowly, his fists clenched. It was only a moment before it would bong, bong, bong its way to 9 o'clock. Connor stood there until the second hand glided around and reached the 12. The instant the bongs were about to start, he grabbed the pendulum, holding it at the high point of its swing. He could hear the mechanism of the clock complaining as the first "buh" of the interrupted bong hovered in the air. With his free hand, Connor reached up and pushed the minute and second hands forward from the 12. They resisted, but he pushed harder, hearing a loud click as he did so that didn't sound especially good. The minute and second hands sprung suddenly free from whatever was holding them back, and Connor spun them around, catching up with the hour hand and taking it along too, hearing more complaining half-bongs and painful clicks from deep inside the wooden case. He could feel drops of sweat gathering on his forehead, and his chest felt like it was glowing with heat. Almost like being in the nightmare. That same feverish blur of the world slipping off its axis. But this time, he was the one in control. This time, he was the nightmare. The second hand,
the thinnest of the three, suddenly snapped and fell out of the clock face completely, bouncing once on the rug and disappearing into the ashes of the hearth. Connor stepped back quickly, letting go of the pendulum. It dropped to its centre point, but didn't start swinging again. Nor did the clock make any of the whirring, ticking sounds it usually made as it ran, its hands now frozen solidly in place. Uh-oh. Connor's stomach started squeezing as he realized what he'd done. Oh, no, he thought. Oh, no. He'd broken it. A clock that was probably worth more than his mum's whole beaten-up car. His grandma was going to kill him. Maybe actually, literally kill him. Then he noticed. The hour and minute hands had stopped at a specific time. 12:07.
As destruction goes, the monster said behind him, this is all remarkably pitiful.
Connor whirled around. Somehow, some way, the monster was in his grandma's sitting room. It was far too big, of course, having to bend down very, very low to fit under the ceiling, its branches and leaves twisting together tighter and tighter to make it smaller. But here it was, filling up every corner.
It is the kind of destruction I would expect from a boy, it said, its breath blowing back Connor's hair. What are you doing here? Connor asked.
He felt a sudden surge of hope. Am I asleep? Is this a dream? Like when you broke my bedroom window, and I woke up, and...
I have come to tell you the second tale, the monster said.
Connor made an exasperated sound and looked back at the broken clock. Is it going to be as bad as the last one? He asked, distractedly.
It ends in proper destruction, if that is what you mean.
Connor turned back to the monster. Its face had rearranged itself into the expression Connor recognized as the evil grin. Is it a cheating story? Connor asked. Does it sound like it's going to be one way and then it's a total other way?
No, said the monster. It is about a man who thought only of himself.
The monster smiled again, looking even more wicked.
And he gets punished very, very badly indeed.
Connor stood breathing for a second, thinking about the broken clock, about the scratches on the hardwood, about the poisonous berries dropping from the monster onto his grandma's clean floor. He thought about his father. I'm listening, Connor said. The second tale.
150 years ago, the monster began, this country had become a place of industry. Factories grew on the landscape like weeds. Trees fell, fields were upended, rivers blackened. The sky choked on smoke and ash, and the people did too, spending their days coughing and itching, their eyes turned forever towards the ground. Villages grew into towns, towns into cities, and people began to live on the earth, rather than within it. But there was still green, if you knew where to look.
The monster opened its hands again, and a mist rolled through his grandma's sitting room. When it cleared, Connor and the monster stood on a field of green, overlooking a valley of metal and brick. So I am asleep, Connor said.
Quiet! Said the monster. Here he comes.
And Connor saw a sour-looking man with heavy black clothes and a deep, deep frown climbing the hill towards them.
Along the edge of this green lived a man. His name is not important, as no one ever used it. The villagers only ever called him the apothecary.
The what? Connor asked.
The apothecary, said the monster.
The what?
Apothecary was an old-fashioned name, even then, for a chemist.
Oh, Connor said. Why didn't you just say?
But the name was well-earned, because apothecaries were ancient, dealing in the old ways of medicine, too, of herbs and barks, of concoctions brewed from berries and leaves.
Dad's new wife does that, Connor said, as they watched the man dig up a root. She owns a shop that sells crystals.
The monster frowned.
It is not remotely the same. Many a day, the apothecary went walking to collect the herbs and leaves of the surrounding green. But as the years passed, his walks became longer and longer, as the factories and roads sprawled out of town, like one of the rashes he was so effective in treating. Where he used to be able to collect Pax Foil and Bella Rosa before morning tea, it began to take him the entire day. The world was changing, and the apothecary grew bitter. Or rather, more bitter, for he had always been an unpleasant man. He was greedy, and charged too much for his cures, often taking more than the patient could afford to pay. Nevertheless, he was surprised at how unloved he was by the villagers, thinking they should treat him with far more respect. And because his attitude was poor, their attitude towards him was also poor, until, as time went on, his patients began seeking other, more modern remedies from other, more modern healers, which only, of course, made the apothecary even more bitter.
The mist surrounded them again, and the scene changed. They were now standing on a lawn atop a small hillock. A parsonage sat to one side, and a great yew tree stood in the middle of a few new headstones.
In the apothecary's village, there also lived a parson.
"This is the hill behind my house," Connor interrupted. He looked around, but there was no railway line yet. No rows of houses, just a few footpaths and a mucky riverbed.
"The parson had two daughters," the monster went on, "who were the light of his life."
Two young girls came screaming out of the parsonage, giggling and laughing and trying to hit each other with handfuls of grass. They ran around the trunk of the yew tree, hiding from one another. "That's you," Connor said, pointing at the tree, which for the moment was just a tree.
"Yes, fine. On the parsonage grounds there also grew a yew tree." "And a very handsome yew tree it was," said the monster.
"If you say so yourself," Connor said.
"Now, the apothecary wanted the yew tree very badly."
"He did?" Connor asked. "Why?"
The monster looked surprised.
"The yew tree is the most important of all the healing trees," it said. "It lives for thousands of years. Its berries, its bark, its leaves, its sap, its pulp, its wood, they all thrum and burn and twist with life. It can cure almost any ailment man suffers from, mixed and treated by the right apothecary."
Connor furrowed his forehead. "You're making that up." The monster's face went stormy.
"You dare to question me, boy?"
"No," Connor said, stepping back at the monster's anger. "I just never heard that before." The monster frowned angrily for a moment longer, then got on with the story.
"In order to harvest these things from the tree, the apothecary would have had to cut it down, and this the parson would not allow. The yew had stood on this ground long before it was set aside for the church. A graveyard was already starting to be used, and a new church building was in the planning stages. The yew would protect the church from the heavy rains and the harshest weather, and the parson, no matter how often the apothecary asked, for he did ask very often, would not allow the apothecary anywhere near the tree. Now the parson was an enlightened man, and a kind one. He wanted the very best for his congregation, to take them out of the dark ages of superstition and witchery. He preached against the apothecary's use of the old ways, and the apothecary's foul temper and greed made certain these sermons fell on eager ears. His business shrank even further. But then, one day, the parson's daughters fell sick. First the one, and then the other, with an infection that swept the countryside.
The sky darkened, and Connor could hear the coughing of the daughters within the parsonage. Could also hear the loud praying of the parson and the tears of the parson's wife.
Nothing the parson did helped. No prayer, no cure from the modern doctor two towns over, no remedies of the field offered shyly and secretly by his parishioners. Nothing. The daughters wasted away and approached death. Finally, there was no other option but to approach the apothecary. The parson swallowed his pride, and went to beg the apothecary's forgiveness. "Won't you help my daughters?" the parson asked, down on his knees at the apothecary's front door. "If not for me, then for my two innocent girls." "Why should I?"